Hi, Dave Emery here, side two of For the Record program number 802, The Luxembourg Connection, subtitled, What the Hell Does Dave Emery Mean by Underground Reich, part two. This is being recorded on July 13th of the year 2014. Once again, the library of anti-fascist books available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, as well as the other programs that I have recorded over the years. I'm in my 35th year on the air. All of that material and the long written descriptions for those programs are available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Often the descriptions have information that I did not have time to fit in the original program. The SpitfireList.com website and all of the information on it are front and center and serve as an essential foundation for the understanding of this program, as is the case with so many others. Again, we're recording this on July 13th of 2014. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off on side one. Now, we were talking about the fact that the German protege, former Luxembourg Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker, is now going to be the president of the European Commission, in all probability with Martin Selmayr, the former Bertelsmann employee and a German, as his cabinet director, an individual who will thereby be in the position to exercise sub rosa control beyond the reach of public scrutiny and democratic influence. The aforementioned Jean-Claude Juncker, along with people like Martin Selmayr, who was formerly the head of Viviane Reding's cabinet and regarded as the de facto commissioner of justice for the EU. Viviane Reding is also from Luxembourg. The foundations of the German power political hand in the Luxembourg glove were set through economic relationships that were developed as the result of cartels that evolved before World War II and that were folded completely under German control during the occupation of Europe in World War II. After the war ended, that control was maintained through the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Network, about which I speak so often. We're going to go into the book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning. Paul Manning broadcast The Surrender of Germany and Japan on the CBS radio network, was a protege of and colleague of Edward R. Murrow, began his research into the Bormann network with the encouragement of Edward R. Murrow, and his work was underwritten by CBS News, which wouldn't touch the story. The Bormann network, as we looked at in For the Record 152 and in 604, forced the cancellation of some of Paul Manning's literary contracts. Finally, Lyle Stewart published the book, and ultimately Paul Manning's son, Jerry Manning, was murdered in retribution for his continued research. Lyle Stewart also had both of his legs broken shortly after the publication of the book. The official story was that he broke both of his legs falling downstairs. He then promptly retired to Jamaica in order to recover, and that just is not credible. Now, the key name in what we're about to see is a guy named Gustav Koenigs, K-O-E-N-I-G-S. Gustav Koenigs was the primary German overseer for Luxembourg's industry and its ARBED, that's capital A-R-B-E-D, all in capitals, steel cartel in particular. Gustav Koenigs was also chairman of the Hamburg America Shipping Line, one of the Bush family Nazi businesses that we have studied in For the Record programs 761, 435, and 475 in particular. Later, as we will see, Gustav Koenigs was Gustav Koenigs was Secretary of State for the Third Reich. On pages 79 and 80 in Paul Manning's Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, again, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, we read of the folding of the economies of occupied countries into the overall pan-European German-controlled economy of the Third Reich, we read, a similar pattern was developed for Luxembourg, a country that is smaller than Rhode Island and whose principal industry is iron and steel. The Germans annexed Luxembourg as they did Alsace-Lorraine, and it became an administered territory like Poland, Belgium, and Holland, where local nationals did not serve as government. Gustav Koenigs, K-O-E-N-I-G-S, the chairman of the Hamburg-America shipping line and a director of many companies, was appointed Reich trustee of Arbed, an important Luxembourg steel cartel by the German Ministry of Economics. There were in Arbed 250,000 shares outstanding, the majority of them held by Luxembourgers, Belgians, and French in that order. German shareholders, largely through their banks, accounted for 54,747 shares. Some were also held by British and Americans through their secret accounts in Swiss banks. A shift in control was made when Gustav Koenigs, as Reich trustee, also became trustee of the Belgian and French-held shares. On April 19, 1943, a shareholders' meeting was held in Luxembourg City, and the capital of the company was converted, that's C-A-P-I-T-A-L, the capital of the company was converted from francs into Reichsmarks. Arbed was recapitalized at 300 million Reichsmarks, or $120 million, and under German direction, the cartel became the third largest iron and steel company in Europe, ranking behind only Germany's Vereinigte Stahlwerke, later renamed Thyssen AG, parenthetically another of the Busch family-linked businesses, and the Gehring Steelworks. A sales company was then formed under the name Luxembourg Iron and Steel Company to market all of Arbed products throughout Europe. It was capitalized at 1.5 million Reichsmarks, parenthetically, this is in the 1940s. Continuing, to further tighten German control over the iron and steel output of this small, mountainous country, all of the iron mines in Luxembourg were combined and amalgamated into one unified association under German direction. This association was named Lutzelurg, L-U-E-T-Z-E-L-L-U-R-G, and its advisory board was appointed by the chief of the German civil administration, Gustav Koenigs, as Reich trustee of Arbed, who served as the president of Lutzelurg. The two principal German banks, Deutsche Bank and Dresdner Bank, had assumed 73% ownership of the Banque Générale de Luxembourg and the Banque Internationale de Luxembourg in May of 1940. They bought majority shares of the two Luxembourg banks from the Belgian and French banks, where they had increased their shareholdings to a controlling interest. Both Commerzbank and the Deutschen Arbeit banks established branches in Luxembourg. So again, note that Gustav Koenigs, the head of the Hamburg-America shipping line, one of the Busch family Nazi-linked businesses, is the key figure in the administration of Luxembourg assets and the Arbed steel cartel in particular during the war. Now, after the war, once again, at the direction of the Grand Ducal family of Luxembourg, the same relationship between the Luxembourg capital and Germany was maintained, and Luxembourg became a key element of the Bormann, the remarkable and deadly Bormann capital network. Returning again, bear in mind, though, by the way, that when Jean-Claude Juncker was obliged to resign as Prime Minister of Luxembourg by that conversation, secretly taped by his intelligence chief, Gladio participant Marc O'Meal, who then became head of security for Siemens. Bear in mind that those conversations, or the operations, the machinations of Gladio, implicated the Grand Ducal family of Luxembourg and thereby opened them up to political blackmail as well. Returning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, on pages 155 and 156, we read, even Grand Duchess Charlotte of Luxembourg had her own ideas and they did not jibe with those of the U.S. investigative team dispatched to her tiny country to set things right after the war. Upon her return from exile in London and Montreal, she promptly dismissed the U.S. investigative mission, which had been attempting to uncover secrets of the German-Luxembourg steel cartel. Elbert D. Thomas of Utah, when he was chairman of the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Military Affairs, commented in Washington on June 26, 1945, quote, "We had a mission in Luxembourg which was obtaining quite a bit of information on the steel cartel until the Grand Duchess returned. Information was then blocked off from us, and the mission had to retire with what information they had already collected. There was much to learn about the way in which small states like Luxembourg had been used by the cartels. The episode suggests that some rulers whom we have befriended may be expected to assist the cartelists in their post-war efforts to regain dominance," unquote. When the Grand Duchess learned from her finance minister on her return to Luxembourg was simple. Quote, "Don't tamper with the money machine. We made record profits during the German era, and there is every indication we will be going into an even greater period of prosperity once Germany recovers. They will then continue to be our biggest customer. All that is required now is a readjustment in stock ownership to please Belgian, French, British, and American shareholders, which will be done." Unquote. Open German stock ownership was reduced to its former position of about 20% in Luxembourg industry, and the German trustee was eliminated. Parenthetically, that was Gustav Koenigs. But at board meetings, Belgian and French banks voted as blocks on behalf of stockholders in Germany. The German voice in the wings was still there, and as time went on in Luxembourg, increasingly the voice could be heard loud and clear. The customer speaking to the seller, the equalizer of the marketplace. Grand Duchess Charlotte, who was to retire during the 60s to be succeeded by her son, Grand Duke Jean, always believed that the new prosperity of Luxembourg after the war was testimony to her decision in 1945 not to permit interference with the German financial and industrial apparatus. The German banks Deutsche and Dresdner remained in position, and the Luxembourg financial community continued to look to Frankfurt rather than to Zurich, London, and New York for financial guidance. Arbed, its sales organization in New York City, its Amerux products, continues as a powerful and prosperous steel cartel closely tied to its German mentors. By 1980, Luxembourg was to become a new center for gold buying in Europe, with West German banks selling the equivalent of $1.4 billion in gold to holders in Luxembourg. The chief attraction was the lack of a value-added tax, a form of sales tax. So again, after the war, courtesy of the Grand Ducal family of Luxembourg, who appear to have been subject to blackmail by Marco Mille over the Gladio-related bombings, the Luxembourg economy remains a key element of the Bormann capital network. And again, I think it can be clearly seen how the German hand in the Luxembourg glove that manifests itself with the relationship between Helmut Kohl and Angela Merkel and Jean-Claude Juncker on one hand, and also Martin Selmayr, Jean-Claude Juncker, and Viviane Reding on the other. I think the relationship is quite clear. Now, we alluded to Gustav Koenigs, who was in charge of Luxembourg industry for the Third Reich, and also head of the Hamburg America line, one of the Bush family related businesses, from the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, and the link is in the description for the show. We read about Gustav Koenigs, who was Secretary of State for the Third Reich. This is in 1942. And it's setting the grounds for the European Economic Community. And Gustav Koenigs is quoted here At the moment, the so-called European Economic Community is not yet fact. There is no pact, no organization, no council, and no general secretary. However, it is not just a part of our imagination or some dream by a politician. It is very real. Its roots are in the economic cooperation of the European nations, and it will develop after the war into a permanent European Economic Community. And so it did. One of the people, by the way, helping to form the EMU was Jean-Claude Juncker. And another interestingly enough, was former French President François Mitterrand. Now, in the article we're about to read, François Mitterrand is portrayed as an opponent of Germany who helped to press for the European Monetary Union as a bulwark against Germany, as we have looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M61 from 1994. François Mitterrand, in fact, was a longtime collaborator with French fascism. He was a collaborator with the Cagoule and the Croix de Feu, two French fascist organizations that attempted to overthrow the French government in 1938. They then became key collaborationist elements with the Vichy fascists that managed France for the Germans. One of Mitterrand's idols was Marechal Pétain, who was the head of the Vichy government. And we're going to talk some more about François Mitterrand. He was in the French army, was captured by the Germans, and I think it is not a reach at all to see him as a sub rosa cat's paw of Germany and not an opponent of Germany at all. The following is from the Business Spectator of August 17th, 2011, a Euro power play that backfired by Oliver Mark Hartwich. And it talks about a guy named Robert Zoellick at this point in time, president of the World Bank. He was one of the American architects of German reunification and also a key George W. Bush official involved with helping to open up the U.S. economy to participation by companies like T-Mobile, which is controlled by Deutsche Telekom, an agency of the German government. Skipping down here, we read, Europe's common currency has practically achieved the very opposite of what its creators originally intended. Parenthetically, I take that with a huge dose of salt. Instead of framing the Germans in Europe, the crisis has elevated Germany to the continent's new, albeit reluctant, hegemon. Again, that should be taken with a massive dose of salt. After the fall of the Berlin Wall in November of 1989, Robert Zoellick was the lead U.S. official in the 2+4 negotiations that prepared Germany's reunification in October of 1990, so named after the two German states and the four Allied forces, Britain, France, the Soviet Union, and the U.S. He was thus intimately involved in the diplomatic balancing act of unifying Germany, while reassuring the British and the French that they had nothing to fear from this new and bigger country in the heart of Europe. For his achievements, Zoellick was even made a Knight Commander of the German Order of Merit, a very high award for a German national. Skipping down. Robert Zoellick's remarks at the Sydney dinner are all, this is Sydney, Australia, all the more remarkable. Almost in passing, and as if it was the most obvious thing in the world, he explained his understanding of how Europe got its common currency, and his account confirmed the rumors that it had a lot to do with German unification. As Zoellick told his audience that was probably unaware of how controversial such issues still are in Europe, it was very clear that that European Monetary Union resulted from French-German tensions before unification and was meant to calm Mitterrand's fears of an all-too-powerful Germany. In all probability, I think Mitterrand was a German agent. Continuing, according to Zoellick, the euro currency is a byproduct of German unification. As one of the key insiders in the 2+4 negotiations, trusted and highly decorated by the Germans, nobody would be better qualified to know the real story behind European Monetary Union. Despite all official denials coming from the German government until the present day, there are no good reasons not to believe Zoellick's account of the events. The great historical irony of this is, of course, that if the French had really planned to weaken the powers of newly reunited Germany through monetary union, this attempt has now completely backfired. Sure, the Germans will pay massively for the sake of keeping the Euro project alive if they don't pull out of monetary union once they realize this, but in strategic terms, Germany's influence has never been greater. And again, I don't think that François Mitterrand was a dupe here or that he would be rolling over in his grave. On the contrary, in addition to the information in, for the record, M61, which is linked in the description for this show of François Mitterrand's French fascist background and associations, we should note that François Mitterrand was very closely associated with a guy named René Bousquet, B-O-U-S-Q-U-E-T, who is a French police official who collaborated very closely with the Gestapo in the liquidation of French Jewry and the suppression of French democracy. And as we're about to see, René Bousquet in the post-war period maintained a very close relationship to François Mitterrand and apparently also helped to finance not only Mitterrand's post-war French career, but those of many other ostensibly left-leaning French politicians as well. From Wikipedia, Mitterrand and the far right, we read, "The most damning of all charges against Mitterrand and his right-wing connections is probably his long-lasting friendship with René Bousquet, ex-secrétaire général of the Vichy police. Charles de Gaulle said of Mitterrand and Bousquet, quote, they are ghosts who come from the deepest depths of the collaboration, unquote, skipping down. In 1974, René Bousquet gave financial help to François Mitterrand for his presidential campaign against Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. In an interview with Pierre Favier and Michel Martin-Roland, Mitterrand claimed that he was not only the only left-wing politician to benefit from Bousquet's money, as René Bousquet helped finance all the principal left-wing politicians from the 1950s to the beginning of the 1970s, including Pierre Mendès France. Worse still, after Mitterrand's 1981 win, René Bousquet was received at the Champs-Élysées Palace to, quote, talk politics, unquote. In an interview with Pascal Fourmont, René Bousquet's biographer, Mitterrand declared, quote, I listened to him as a political commentator, and skipping down, as Lionel Jospin, J-O-S-P-I-N, noted, what I can't understand is the continuing relationship into the 80s with the likes of Bousquet, who organized the mass arrests of Jews, and Charles Fitemont, F-I-T-E-R-N-A-N, also felt left down. These revelations leave the uncomfortable impression of having been deceived by the man. 50 years later, we see no trace of regret nor critical analysis, but a continuation of a compromising relationship which casts new light on events such as putting flowers on Pétain's tomb. This seems to show a continuity in the choices of a leader calling in favors from a network of friends." And I suspect that one of those favors was pressuring for the creation of the EMU. Again, the realization of the plans of Friedrich List, as we have seen many times, most recently in, for the record, 788. More about François Mitterrand's political benefactor and post-war financial angel. Once again, from Wikipedia on their entry into René Bousquet, again, B-O-U-S-Q-U-E-T. On July 2nd, 1942, Bousquet and SS Karl Oberg prepared the arrests known as the Ville d'Hiv roundup, that's D-apostrophe-H-I-V. Bousquet personally counseled orders protecting some categories of people from arrests, notably children under 18 and parents with children under 5. After the arrests, some bishops and cardinals protested. Bousquet threatened to cancel tax privileges for Catholic schools in retaliation. Under the pretext of not separating families, Pierre Laval ordered that Jewish children under 16 be included in deportation convoys, thus surpassing the requirements of the Nazis themselves. Bousquet obliged, personally settling that children under 2 years old also be included. Children were actually deported separately from their parents. In January of 1943, Bousquet organized with SS Karl Olberg a massive raid in Marseille known as the Battle of Marseille. During this repressive operation, the French police assisted the German police in particular in the expulsion of 30,000 people from the Old Port and the subsequent destruction of this neighborhood, considered as too dangerous and as a, quote, terrorist nest, unquote, by the German police, partly because of its winding, small streets. Bousquet eagerly offered his services during this operation. The French police controlled the identity of 40,000 people, and the operation succeeded in sending 2,000 Marseillais to the extermination camps. The operation also encompassed the expulsion of an entire neighborhood of 30,000 persons before its destruction. For this occasion, SS Karl Olberg, in charge of the German police in France, made the trip from Paris and transmitted to Bousquet orders directly received from SS Chief Heinrich Himmler. It is a notable case of the French police's willing collaboration with the Nazis. In April of 1943, Bousquet met personally with Heinrich Himmler. Himmler declared himself, quote, impressed by Bousquet's personality, unquote, mentioning him as a, quote, precious collaborator in the framework of police collaboration, unquote. And again, that's the guy who was Mitterrand's post-war financial angel, and I think that taken in combination with Mitterrand's association with the Cagoule, the Croix de Feu, his idolization of Maréchal Pétain. I don't think Mitterrand's role, along with Jean-Claude Juncker in helping to implement the euro, was unwilling at all. I think he was a sub rosa operative of the underground Reich. And lest people think that, well, you know, this is just statecraft as usual, or it's old stuff, it's European history, and you know, who cares? From the Talking Points memo Live Wire of July 8th of 2014, we conclude with the following. This is by Caitlin McNeil, M-A-C, capital N-E-A-L. Neo-Nazi Holocaust denier joins EU Parliament Civil Rights Committee. A neo-Nazi from Germany's ultra-conservative National Democratic Party joined the European Union's Parliament in May, and on Monday, he took a seat on the body's Civil Rights Committee. Udo Voigt has praised Adolf Hitler as a great German statesman, unquote, and once claimed that, quote, no more than 340,000 Jews died in the Holocaust, as opposed to the 6 million figure agreed on by historians, according to The Guardian. Voigt led the NDP from 1996 to 2011. Voigt was convicted of glorifying the Waffen-SS in 2009. In 2007, he considered nominating Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy, for a Nobel Peace Prize. The Guardian has an extensive account of his incredibly controversial actions and statements here, and there's a link. Again, this guy is now on the European Parliament's Civil Rights Committee. This concludes Side 2. For the record, program number 802, The Luxembourg Connection, subtitled, What the Hell Does Dave Emery Mean by Underground Reich, Part 2, being recorded on July 13th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.